Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 329, recorded Friday, January 12th, 2018. Gastronomad Mike Elkin. Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire? ZipRecruiter offers simple tools and powerful matching technology to find you qualified candidates efficiently and effectively. It's the smartest way to hire. Try it free at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and it understands the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show. Hey, yeah, I get to be here for a change. Thanks to Jason Howell and Megan Maroney and Father Robert Ballasaire, who are taking the Triangulation rotation with me. Once a month, I get to come in, and I get to pick who I want to meet. And this time, it's somebody I've wanted to meet for so long. Mr. Mike Elkin is here.
I've always wanted to meet you too, Leo.
So nice. Actually, it's good timing because you have a book out now.
I do.
And a lot of people come on Triangulation to plug books, and this is a good one to plug. It's called Gastronomad, The Art of Living Everywhere and Eating Everything. But you all, if anybody's been watching TWiT for a while, knows Mike very well. He's a regular on the TWiT Roundtable. Always a welcome guest. For some couple of years was here doing our news on Tech News Today. And it's great to have you back. Now you're back traveling the world.
Yep. Love doing it. Yeah, that 2 years, it was. You had me chained to a desk. Not a lot of traveling
against,
in that period.
Against your will. In fact, I was reading the introduction to this, and I realized that I was kind of violating your life's goal.
No. In fact, the fact that, you know, you said, come do the news, and I said, okay. The reason I could do that was I didn't own a home in some other
That's true.
State
you were footloose and fancy free.
Exactly.
By the way, thank you for acknowledging Lisa and me in the
Thank you for the
acknowledgments on this book. That's not why you're here. You're here because you're a dear friend. You make the best damn pizza I've ever had.
Thank you.
and when you're in the U.S., so when did the urge to travel hit you, bite you?
Many years ago, I heard about digital nomad living, right? So I thought, you know, I can work remotely. I'm a writer, you know, and I thought I'd give it a try.
So this was how long ago?
2006.
Oh, a long time ago.
Yes, 12 years ago. And what happened was we wanted to go, our family, to Central America.
Because you have two boys. They were teenagers then.
Well, one I think was early 20s and the other one's a teenager.
Okay.
We thought we want to go and explore ruins and check out the Mayan world. It's going to take us about 6 weeks. How do we pull that off? And I thought, you know what? I'm going to tell my editors that I'm going to be gone and you know, don't reach me. And then I thought, you know what? I'm not going to tell them.
Don't tell them at all.
I'm not going to say a thing.
Wow.
And this is, again, 2006 in Central America, where I was back in those days, you could find Wi-Fi at a hotel,
but
they often didn't password protect it at all.
Yeah.
You could just saddle up to the hotel and use their Wi-Fi. And they didn't know. I was on conference calls.
No kidding. Nobody ever twigged to the fact that you were not in the U.S.?
Nobody noticed that I wasn't an American. I thought, wow, this is an entirely different... This is a new world.
Easier now than it was then, even.
It's way easier now.
Yeah. Here's a picture of you, your beautiful wife, Amira, who is the best cook ever, and your two sons, Kevin and Kenny. That's
the very trip I'm talking about
trip,
right there.
Guatemala.
Yeah, that is Lake Atitlan. And that was a fantastic thing. The boat dropped us off on that dock, and we sort of lived in this sort of precarious hotel that was kind of on the side of a cliff.
What fun.
And it was just, it's a great thing to do to kids. But it occurred to me that I could do this all the time, and we just kept getting more and more into it. And eventually we just completely got rid of our house. We put all of our stuff into storage.
Wow.
And we did it full time for many years at a time.
Yeah, when we first met, you had no, what do they call it, permanent place of abode?
That's right. Yeah.
you were footloose. So, but before 2006, you were, and I know I was always aware of you, a very well-known tech writer. When did you start doing that? Did you start in regular journalism and then focus?
I did. So right out of school, I went to UCLA. Right out of school, I got a job at local newspaper. So Santa Barbara County.
Yeah.
So I was initially a reporter for three newspapers there.
My favorite tech reporters started doing real newspaper reporting.
Yep, yep.
And there's a discipline to that. I think of Stacey Higginbotham. I think of Jeff, of course, and a lot of my favorite reporters.
Yeah.
There's a discipline, and also I think you also have to patience, because you're not covering the most fascinating things in the world.
You know, you're kind of like a fireman. It's either the most fascinating, terrifying thing in the world, or it's boring as can be.
It's either a city council meeting,
exactly,
or a helicopter crash.
Well, the first week I was a reporter, I had to cover. I had an interview a woman whose baby died of SIDS, for example. Just gut wrenching, and I thought,
worst.
Oh my gosh, what did I? You know, I wasn't thinking about that kind of journalism.
Yeah, you thought you'd be Geraldo Rivera. Or something. Yeah,
and there was a spate of horrible disasters in Santa Barbara County. First the fires, then
just
the flooding.
Now the mudslides in Montecito. Yeah,
but one of my first stories was to cover a huge fire back then.
Yeah,
and that was just really
my aunt lost her house in that fire.
Oh, really?
I think it was right about that time frame. Yeah,
yeah. There was something like 500 homes back in those days. That was a big fire. And so that was great for a while. I quickly got promoted to managing editor of all three of the newspapers.
Why was that? Was that because you're pretty young at that point?
Yeah, I was kind of I was super into politics and super into, you know, I was a political science major at UCLA. And I've always had a crazy hard work ethic.
Our generation was so influenced by Watergate and all the president's men.
Yeah.
We all wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein.
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did.
Was that your goal?
That was kind of my goal, but I was also fascinated by that whole area has all these like historical unsolved murders and things from like the 20s.
Really?
Yeah, and I was like, I'm going to solve these.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I never
did the Black Dahlia, but that was L.A., right?
Yeah. That was L.A. But, you know, Montecito is kind of a moneyed extension Hollywood.
Right.
And so there's
Oprah
a lot.
Oprah has a house there.
Yeah. It's part of the culture there. So so I was really fascinated by that. But it was actually another trip, one of my most eye-opening trips, where I decided I wanted to be in technology journalism. Because
how did that happen?
Well, so we were, it's hard to believe now, we're talking late 80s. And
by the way, it wasn't the most exciting period in technology.
No.
Okay.
Not really. But it was exciting for me because I arrived right as we were about to transition from like, we're essentially putting wax, you know, printing out the columns on paper.
Right.
And essentially photographing it. That
right.
was the, and then the printing press was in the other room. So
right.
It's like when it was printing, it was the whole building.
Oh,
was
you're from the in a generation where you smell the ink.
Yes.
And you feel maybe more than hear the printing presses going. I mean, it's really a visceral experience.
Leo, we actually got to stop the presses a couple of times.
And you could feel it. Wow.
So, but I got there right when we were switching to an all Macintosh system.
Yeah.
And I had a kind of an affinity for that. And so I was heavily involved in that transition. And I fell completely in love with desktop publishing and Ethernet networking and
so
all
the
rest
of it. Mac came out in 84 and shortly thereafter, PageMaker,
Quark
and the laser
Express.
And Quark Express and the Laser Writer,
exactly.
And people started doing desktop publishing in the mid '80s,
exactly. And so I spent my whole time just, you know, using Quark Express, using these tools, and it was really exciting back then. I mean, it was really, I really enjoyed
it. Empowering. Did you think you could do it yourself at this point, or no?
Not the whole publishing part.
You hadn't got to that part.
Yeah, I mean, I actually published a newsletter in college for my fellow political science. But I went to Kinko's basically, printed it out, and I distributed pieces of paper.
Right.
It was barbaric, Leo.
Savages.
Yeah, savages. So an interesting thing happened because I was covering city politics and so on. A city councilman nominated me for a trip to go to Brazil.
Wow.
For I think it was 5-6 weeks of young professionals. You had to be in your 20s. And then we went to southern Brazil, and some Brazilians came to Santa Barbara. And so for about 5-6 weeks, I was essentially this VIP touring all these areas in southern Brazil.
Had you traveled much before this?
Not that much, actually. A little bit. I'd been to Europe once before, twice before, and never been to South America, never been to, certainly, Brazil. We had Berlitz language, intensive language training,
yeah,
full-time.
Learned Portuguese,
for, yeah. We were giving speeches in Portuguese.
Wow.
We were doing all this kind of stuff. But it was a really fascinating thing because we didn't go to Rio, we didn't go to the, you know, Brasilia, we didn't go to any of the fancy places. We were in the farmland and we were seeing factories and farms and all this kind of stuff, interacting with, living in people's homes.
Right? That's really interesting.
Every week we'd switched.
This was a governmental program?
It was a Rotary Club.
It was the Rotary Club,
which in Latin America is like a very elite organization.
And so it was like a person-to-person cultural exchange.
Exactly. Exactly.
Interesting.
And so I got lost in a jungle in southern Brazil. We were doing this tour. We're looking at this farm and all this stuff, and I was wandering around, and I was like, I don't know where I am. And I was kind of lost for a couple of hours.
Wow.
And during that time, I had this epiphany, which is that enough with the water politics already. What I love about my job is the Macs. Is the Macintoshes, the Quark Express,
the tech,
the networking. I love that stuff.
But wait a minute, you had this epiphany in the jungle.
In the jungle.
So it wasn't that there was technology around you. Was want to get back to my Mac?
Yeah, I want to get back to my life. This is what I love about my life. Is
how interesting. Well, isn't that a kind of a blessing that you got lost?
Absolutely. So I came out of this jungle and then realized they have computer magazines. You know, I can do journalism, but in areas where I really care about.
Kind of the heyday of computer magazines, late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
There Ziff Davis, there was IDG.
Yep. And so...
And they were battling it out.
And I was like, I'll move to New York City. I'll move anywhere I have to work to work at one of these publications. And it just so happened there was a small publication in that little town in Carpinteria, where I grew up, that was actually doing a significant...
Neat.
Tech publication.
Now, had you met Amira? Were you married? And did you have a family?
I had met Amira. We had a family. I had my youngest was a baby.
So this is brave.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the time, you know, when you're young, you think it's all going to be great. You know,
another job. I can
That's
do
right.
that. Yeah.
And so here's how funny this transition was. The first episode, the first issue of the publication that I worked at was called OS2 Magazine. The second issue was called OS2 and Windows. The third issue was called Windows and OS2. And the fourth issue was called Windows Magazine.
I, of course, subscribed to Windows Magazine, but I had no idea it started off as OS2 Magazine.
It did.
And in four issues, OS2 was
That's
gone.
Right. That's and right.
It's a shame. Actually, OS2 was awesome.
Yeah.
And to people probably don't remember, it was an IBM operating system. John C. Dvorak was like a huge OS2 fan.
Yeah.
And they put in a Windows 3.1 compatibility mode, which was actually more than compatibility. It was really Windows was in
That's
it.
Right. That's right.
Because there was a trade-off between IBM and Microsoft. Engineers from IBM went to Microsoft to work on Windows, and Microsoft engineers went to IBM to work on OS2. And frankly, a lot of the kernel of Windows came from OS2
That's
people,
right.
like Ed Iacobucci, who was on loan from IBM. So it wasn't such a stretch to say OS2 and Windows.
Right.
You were, probably a lot of people were, OS2, somebody told me it's still used in banks.
Wow. ATMs maybe or something.
No, like, well, maybe they've given up by now, but it lasted a lot longer because it was very robust. Yeah. It was a solid operating system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
but
we
not
were,
Mac, not a Mac magazine.
No, actually. I mean, I would have preferred that initially, but then I got super into Windows and Windows and OS2 and all that kind of stuff. And then we were acquired. Actually, it turned out the reason they hired me was they wanted to sort of like build up the magazine for acquisition. Oh. So CMP Publications.
Were they doing the pre-press and layout on Macs, on computers?
We were actually doing all that stuff on Windows back
Even
then.
On Windows, yeah.
Okay. So,
okay. And CMP comes along, which
CMP
is a big magazine. It was the third. It was Ziff Davis and IDG, and then CMP was kind of
That's
a little
right.
bit lower.
CMP up until that point was what's called a business publication,
right.
where they're not selling magazines to consumers on the newsstand.
Right.
They're
Close,
giving them to businesses.
Limited circulation.
That's right, and you have to qualify to get it and all that
I remember
kind of
that.
Stuff.
Like InfoWorld was that way, and PC Week was that way. And,
right.
Yeah.
And so Windows was their first foray into the consumer magazine publication. They hired Fred Langa, who was the editor-in-chief of Byte.
Love.
Flanga.
Yep.
And
Byte was the great magazine at that at that time. I think that was the dominant magazine. Yeah.
And we were all, you know, Fred was our hero, and he came out, and we basically put together the first issue with seven people, which is hard to believe. This is a full on print glossy publication, pretty big, pretty big magazine, and it's hard to imagine this period for the whippersnappers out there that don't remember. What this is all about, but basically this is after the computers confused everybody, but before the internet answered everybody's questions.
There was a need.
There was a huge need. So if you...
The other thing that was different is the internet answered everybody's questions immediately. So a magazine that had a 3-month lead time and came once a month wasn't as useful.
That's right. But it fortunately,
for a while it was.
It took a decade for the world to catch
on
and for the internet to be able to answer everybody's questions.
Yeah.
And during that period, the growth was just...
Oh, yeah.
Stupid growth. I mean, it was like we were publishing 420-page issues.
Holy cow, that's thick.
It was really thick, mostly, you know, it's a huge amount of advertising.
At least half ads.
Yeah. And so it was, you know, like you said, PC Mag, PC World, PC Computing, if you remember these names, and us.
I got all four of them. I subscribed to all four of them.
Yeah. And so.
And Computer Shopper.
Yeah.
Which you could use to make furniture because it was.
Yeah.
Of them all, it was a tabloid size and it was even thicker because it was really all ads.
Yeah.
It was the smallest amount possible of editorial content.
Yeah. But it was a wild west. I mean, we quickly grew to like 62 editorial staff, if you can imagine something like that. Our circulation was like 820,000, something like that.
Is that pretty typical for those magazines, around a million?
Around a million. So the gold standard was PC Mag, which was twice a month.
Right.
And they had a million two, something like that.
But twice a month.
But twice a month.
Right.
And so that, you know, they had a very large lab.
But that's pretty close. You had 820 and, I mean, that's pretty close.
We were all pretty close. We were clustered in there with PC Computing, PC World. Right. So just as an example, in today's lean editorial journalistic times, this is hard to imagine. But I used to, initially I was the managing editor. I would go to the budget people because we wanted to replace all of our PCs every year.
Mm-hmm.
And just, we want the new 486.
Of course.
You know, we want the latest, you know, we want 256 megs of RAM. We want the bleeding edge.
And 10 megahertz this time, 10.
So I did all this preparation to go beg for this huge boost in budget. And eventually the guy just stopped me and said, you can have anything you want.
Wow.
Anything. You guys are making so much money that you can just name it.
Well, there was no competition for advertising. Right. And it was a go-go time for Microsoft, was just, you know, taking over the world.
Yep.
Was it Dell and Gateway IBM was still in the game? Compaq.
And there was a million smaller companies. There's
hard
all
drive
kinds of,
manufacturers there and peripherals.
You recently interviewed Philippe Kahn. So
Borland,
yes,
you bet.
That company.
So they were all buying very expensive ads.
That's right.
Yep. Glossy ads, because there's nowhere else. There's nowhere else to buy ads. You're not going to put it on television,
right?
Or the radio, or the newspaper. You have to buy these magazines.
That's right, and that's where their consumers were. So, and so it was a pretty wild time.
I remember because I worked for Ziff Davis around this time.
Yeah.
And Bill McCrone, who's the editor-in-chief of PC, your direct competition of PC Magazine, was like a god at Comdex. He'd go there. And Bill Gates came to the party. You know, they had the Spencer the Cat party. That's for PC Week.
Right.
Bill Gates would show up. Philippe would show up. Everybody would be there.
It was amazing because people like Bill Gates, he'd be having dinner. You just walk up and say, hey, Bill, and you'd have a conversation.
It was kind of different, too, though, in that it was a big deal, but it was also still a little bit of a niche, right?
Yes, it was.
It's not ubiquitous like it is now. Everybody has a computer in their pocket now.
Right. When I remember in the first episode of Windows, 1990, 91.
You keep calling them episodes. You have become a podcaster, friend.
It's your fault. You've done this to me. But we were bragging. It's like Windows is so huge. It has 4 million users.
Yeah. It's 200 million now, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. And by by 1998 or something like that, it was, I don't know what it was.
But this was Windows 3.0 or 3.1 at this time.
Initially.
It was very early. And then I remember 3.1.1 was the big breakthrough Windows for work groups.
That's right.
That's when it really... And by the time they were doing 95, 10 years later, almost 10 years later, it was it was dominant.
Yeah. So the 90s was great.
Did you go to Comdex like the... Everybody and
I was on the road more than half the time.
You became editor in chief.
Yes,
at some point.
Yes.
How quickly?
Kind of gradually. I was managing editor for a few years. Yeah. I was executive editor, then the editor, and then in the end, there I was. It became weird because I sort of like spent almost all my time as kind of a public face and an editorial. I wrote,
is that the job of the editor-in-chief, really?
If it depends on how big the publication is. I mean, you have to manage the staff and all that kind of stuff. But the managing editor is really the core of a publication to put it together and that sort of thing. But the needs of the public face of it were pretty great. And so I would do the editorial writing. I'd do some other jobs, but I was just constantly traveling.
You were the Anna Wintour of Windows Magazine.
Yes.
So, yeah, because I think, I mean, the funny thing is magazines have survived. PC, computer magazines have not, but magazines have survived. Right. They're maybe even bigger now than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people don't know how it all works. So there's a publisher, and that person is in charge of sales, ad sales, right?
Well,
mostly?
You the typical publisher, you have three components. So you have the editorial world, you have the advertising sales world, and you have circulation.
Yeah.
So circulation is just the whole, you know, shipping the product to customers. Essentially, it's the organization that makes sure that all gets there.
Puts it in boxes that go on trucks that end up at newsstands.
That's right.
Or goes to the postal service and gets mailed out.
Right.
It's very old.
It's very bizarre.
It seems very old-fashioned.
Yeah.
So the publishers are responsible for even editorial.
Yeah,
you think when you hear publisher, that means everything, right?
Right.
Like, but he's not the king of the world, is he?
There's this touchy separation.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of like he's not supposed to meddle or interfere, right. Although they did do that occasionally in all these publications in certain areas.
Like if Microsoft is a big advertiser and you're going to write a hit piece on a Microsoft.
Let me give
product.
You an example of one of the worst things that ever happened to me at Windows Magazine. So we had this incredibly talented cartoonist who was able to mimic the cartoon style of other publications. So he did a Mad Magazine version of Windows Magazine. It was right out of Mad Magazine. And it was called Whichever Way the Wind Blows Magazine. And he had names like Bill Gates and like all these different things.
I love it.
And he just made a mockery of all of us, and of me, of the people in the industry.
It's
and the publisher just snuffed it out. He's like,
really?
No way we're going to make fun of our advertisers. And, you know, that's the kind of
so
stuff.
So they did have that kind of power.
They did. They weren't supposed to exercise
They're not supposed it. To, right? There's right. supposed to be a wall between advertising and editorial.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, nowadays, that seems very old-fashioned.
Because
everybody now is doing their own thing, and they right. sell their ads, and they produce the content, and the editorial. And
I mean, we didn't buy stocks. We didn't take
yeah.
anything from anyone. It was like very scrupulous.
Was there like a agreement? Or like a
no, it was all professional.
It just was how you, just everybody knew.
Exactly.
That's how you did it.
That's right.
Jim Lauterbach used to do that for Ziff Davis, and for at least when I worked for the various Ziff Davis things, Jim would always write the disclaimer and the agreement. And actually, I think at some point they made people sign stuff.
Yeah.
Saying you will not own stocks, you will disclose if you take money from any, you can't have more than a $50 dinner, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that was a good idea.
It is a good idea, because when you get big enough, it becomes impersonal. When there's 10, 15 people, it's like you talk about these things all the time,
right.
And it's just you it isn't done.
Yeah.
As soon as you're hiring interns every like 2 weeks and you're bringing people up and they don't, you know, the younger people don't really.
Nevertheless, the tech companies and their PR arms are always trying to influence you.
Always. Yeah, always.
In a variety of ways. Would they ever throw money at you?
No, never
They're
money.
Never that blatant.
But I had, one of my jobs is to sit down and talk to advertisers, and I would, it was
because you're the
explaining.
The editor-in-chief does, that's in theory, right, the one guy that might be crossing that wall. The publisher and the editor-in-chief are kind of
exactly
talking to each other and then isolating the editorial staff from the rest
exactly.
of
Exactly. So, you know, I used to always tell people that the people who are actually doing the product reviews, they don't know and they don't care.
And they shouldn't.
Who is advertising
yeah.
or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I had actually had advertisers say, look, you know, we spend all this money on advertising. Doesn't it make sense that we should get preferential? And I said, no, absolutely not. That's not how it works.
And they live with it.
And I would tell them that's not how it works at our publication. It's also not how it works at PC Mag or any of these other publications.
Right. Fortunately.
Right.
Because if anybody were to break the ranks, then that person would...
Yeah,
change it for everybody else. Yeah.
yeah.
So well, that's good. I mean, that's encouraging. We always assume that. And at the same time, I think people who read other verticals, like, say, Car and Driver, always figure there's a little bit of one hand washes the other kind of stuff going on.
The problem is access journalism. Because the people who are in positions of journalistic, when you're covering products or you're covering, you know, you're hobnobbing with people in the industry.
Yeah.
And they're always trying to make you feel good. And you're going to these nice events and it's all this fun stuff. And that's what the influence is, a soft influence.
I think they're smart enough not to say, hey, don't write that nasty review.
Exactly.
Instead, and Apple does this very, very well, they put their arms around people and they cultivate them.
Yes. Yep. And so that's just part of being a journalist in any sort of product publication. You have to be hardcore. Personally, I completely avoid Access Journal. I never make friends with anyone in the industry.
Yeah, but you and I, as a result, are kind of marginalized.
That's right.
A little bit.
Well, we both are on the Apple blacklist.
Yeah. But I think also even you pay a price in the sense that the companies don't call you. They don't give you advances. Now you still write for Computer World and Fast Company, so
yes.
You still have a bully pulpit.
Yes.
So do they still call you?
They contact me all the time.
We get emails all the time from PR people, but I just don't answer them. In fact, it's kind of funny because the other day a PR person said, you never answered my email. And I said, what are you talking about? I don't answer any email. If I want to do something, I'll contact you, but don't expect me to respond.
Right.
I thought you must be new here.
Yeah. I mean, I have a whole, this is why I'm addicted to Gmail, because I have so many rules and filters. That as soon as I pull the plug on that thing, I'm going to be buried.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even like to go to events. And as you know, I stay, you're not at CES this year either.
No, not CES. No.
When's the last time you went to CES?
Oh, 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that. Yeah. I mean, I go to lots of events. I like the smaller events where actually notable people, I like the obscure events, the artificial intelligence events and things like that. Those are great.
Well, part of the job of the journal, this is why Access is a big deal. Part of our job is to understand the technologies we're writing about.
Right.
And if you do, for instance, you know, Rene Ritchie goes to Apple and gets briefings and he learns about stuff that you can't otherwise learn about.
Right.
So it's very difficult to refuse all access or cut off of all access can potentially make it very much more difficult to do your job.
You don't want to refuse access. I mean, he's doing his job. That's that, you know, he's doing work there. He's not off
on a yacht.
You have
to balance it. He has to learn that. Right.
And getting drunk with, you know, you're reading a lot more about Silicon Valley and the parties and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, that's the troublesome stuff is when you're playing with people in the industry, interviewing people in the industry. That's our job.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. We're talking with Mike Elgin, my good buddy. I'm proud to say a good friend, but also a longtime tech journalist. We never met in those days. I don't think we ever met. I mean, we probably crossed paths all the time.
Yeah.
But I think I'm antisocial. I think that was my problem. I didn't want to hang out with anybody.
The only time we met was on Screensavers. I was on a show.
Were you on the Screensavers?
A couple of times, yeah. A couple of times. And
I also have no memory for people at all or faces.
I mean, back then I was the Windows guy.
Right.
Right. I was the
Well, and I was interested in Windows.
Yeah,
I still am. And we talked a lot about Windows in those days.
Yeah.
What did you come on to do?
Oh,
I there?
Yeah, oh, yeah, you were there. I have no idea. It must have been Internet Explorer or something.
Who knows what it was?
It was some new product or whatever.
Oh, I got to see if I can find some old tape.
Yeah. You sure had a lot of makeup people back then, Leo. That was
You were there then?
Yes.
Yeah, because
like
that didn't last. There were people in the first year or two, and then as the channel started to slowly fade into the west, everything went away.
Yeah,
including the makeup artists.
Yeah,
that wasn't a bad thing. I hated having because you look at the early tech TV stuff. My hair was always like coiffed.
You never get away with that stuff with HD.
Oh God, no! I wore a ton of makeup. We're going to talk about your book. Don't worry. Great. We're going to talk about traveling. I couldn't resist. And I don't think we've ever had this conversation about the early days.
Yeah.
Both of us toiled in the mines. I less than you. I wasn't really I was brought in by Ziff Davis to introduce them to new media and TV. But I started writing in computer magazines in the early to mid 80s just to support my software and hardware habit, just to get stuff.
Yeah.
Just
like a drug addict.
Yeah, it's like a drug addict, yeah. I sell a little on the side just to keep my habit going. I wrote for Byte and InfoWorld, a bunch of non-existent magazines now, Atari magazines, stuff like that. And it is fun.
Yeah.
And in the early days, it was very exciting because you knew that the things were changing. You could see the world was changing.
Yeah, it was really exciting.
And we kind of knew, we had the inside track to something that was going to, everybody's going to know about in a few years.
Yeah.
Now that everybody knows about it, it's not as much fun. So you found something else, much more interesting, food and travel. We'll talk about that with Mike Elgin, our guest. First, a word from our sponsor, Zip Recruiter. Zip Recruiter is actually something, if you're in the business of hiring, you're going to like. If you're a hiring manager, HR person, or, you know, you have your own business and you do everything, including staff up, you ought to know. I mean, the hiring at a company is the most important thing you do, right? That's what the company is. It's made of people. And hiring the right person can make everything work so much better. Hiring the wrong person is nothing but heartache. How about this? ZipRecruiter, where they do a lot of the work for you. If no one has done a better job of transforming how you find the right talent than ZipRecruiter, they post, first of all, and I think you all know about this because we talked about this a lot, when you post on ZipRecruiter, you're posting more than 100 job sites. Single click of the mouse and Facebook and Twitter. You know, all the social networks. So that's great. But I don't know if we emphasize this enough. After that, they help you by actively looking for the most qualified candidates. They use AI to search through their resumes to match them to your needs. And then they're basically headhunting on your behalf. They invite them to apply to you. Plus, they review every application, again, automatically to identify the top candidates. That way, you don't miss a great match. They make it very easy for you because all of the applicants roll into the ZipRecruiter interface where you can set up screening questions, essays, true, false, multiple choice, however you want to do that. So you can screen out the ones that you just don't even want to bother looking at. They pre-format the resumes that makes them easy to read. And then you can rank them and pick the right person so quickly. This is what makes ZipRecruiter different. Unlike other hiring sites, they don't depend on the right candidates finding you. They go out and find them. No wonder 80% of employees, 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter will get a candidate within a day. Not just a candidate, a great candidate, a qualified candidate, a quality candidate. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes. We've used them. The Fortune 500 uses them. In every industry, everywhere in the country to find the most qualified job candidates, and immediate results are great. You can post right now for free when you go to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation to see how all the big companies that use it. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. It's the smartest way to hire. Free right now, ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. That is one thing that is different in new media is we do the ads.
Yeah.
So we don't really get to stand off so much from the ads. Tell me the truth. Did that make you a little uncomfortable when you were doing tech news today?
No.
Didn't bother you?
Not at all. Not at all.
Why not?
Because I'm a huge fan of advertising, and I think that advertising is the best form of monetization there is because it's democratizing. And the way that you do it here is the best of the best.
We try to be transparent.
Exactly. And so, I mean, as a longtime fan of the network, you know, I've
Before I worked here,
I found myself literally using every product you advertise. Totally worked. I was using all of them.
Well, we do kind of, we're trying to pick ad, and this is a joint process with the advertisers,
right.
But we try to pick, as you know, we try to pick advertisers that match our audience's interests.
Right.
With that, and that's part of it. Nowadays, ads have gotten so out of hand online because basically, companies like Facebook and Google are trying to sell advertisers based on what they know about you.
Yes.
So the more they know about you, the more effective they can be. Right. And that seems, I think, to a lot of people to be an invasion of privacy.
That's right. And the other thing that's problematic is that advertising, when it's produced professionally, they just want the result. They want to get the person to take
the
action.
They don't care about you.
It's by its very nature, manipulative.
Yeah.
Whereas the kind of ads you do, it's all straightforward. I'm going to do an ad now. Here's the ad.
Right.
Here's the product. I really like it.
I call it features and benefits.
Yeah.
I did an Ignite talk that probably wasn't too politic, but it was called Advertising is the Sickness, but New Media is the Cure.
Yeah.
And this was a long time ago, but the idea was, in the earliest days of advertising, it was like the Sears Roebuck catalog. It was like, here's what we offer. You want it? Here's how you get it.
Yeah.
It was very straightforward. And then along come you know, Edward Bernays is the most famous example of this. Right. He was Freud's nephew and used Freudian psychology to trick people into. He was the guy who got women to smoke cigarettes, and
right.
It was because of him you think breakfast is the most important meal of the day, because he was working for the bacon producers.
They had no idea what you wanted.
The pork
council. They said,
council.
I'll decide what you want.
I'll tell you what you
want. I'm going to manufacture desire in your
heart. He invented 4 out of 5 doctors. That phrase, he made it up, but he literally went out, they polled a bunch of doctors and said, well, is it important to eat a hearty breakfast? The doctor said, well, yeah, I guess. 4 out of 5 doctors say eat bacon for breakfast. Made bacon.
They talked to 100 doctors, but it was these four.
It's 4 out of the...
Over here.
Yeah. We picked 5 doctors, and these 4 liked it. It didn't matter. But you're right. That was the whole thing. Listerine was originally a floor cleaner. A floor wasn't a mouthwash. It was for disinfecting floors.
Horrible. And they were just horrible.
And they could, and they, in fact, the advertising agency that came up with Listerine's ads invented the word halitosis so that they could say, you smell... And you need to put floor cleaner in your mouth. I always thought it tasted bad. Now I know why.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I agree with you, but I think that there's still this. People don't like advertising. I think there's a crisis going on.
Well, what people want is they want everything for free.
Right. Free.
That would be ideal.
They don't even want to give it any attention. They don't want ads. They just want everything for.
Right.
And I think I try to explain this isn't going to work. This is not a long-term solution.
That's right. I think people should realize that at some point, the content you're getting, especially if it's good content, has to be paid for by someone somehow.
Right.
And so what's it going to be?
Right.
You know, is it going to be manipulation? Is it going to be, right. you know, Facebook type of algorithms, or is it going to be straightforward?
People tolerate what we do. I think, I want to make it explicit that that's why we do what we do. We want to be ad supported so everybody can listen, but we want to do it transparently so it's not manipulative and it's not an invasion of your privacy.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that is scales. That's part of the problem. I mean, if you're Facebook, you can't. Can't do that,
right?
How are you gonna pay for Facebook unless you do all this?
I don't really care if Facebook pays for itself.
Actually, you're right. I don't care. You know, I don't care either. So. Increasingly, care less and less. Facebook stopped today, went down 4.75%.
That's right.
Because Mark Zuckerberg decided we're gonna. You know what? This was such a shock to me. Yeah. He said we're gonna make the news feed be people you know and care about.
Yeah.
What? It wasn't. No, it wasn't. It was publishers.
I was thinking like a couple of months ago that I should write a piece that says that's what they should do. They should just get out of the content
right.
distribution
do
business.
Do what we think
and
they're
thought,
supposed to do.
I thought that's so far out they'd never even
they would never consider that. You do, how do you get your inspiration? Because you do, when you write now, and you're in a good position because you don't have to come up with a weekly, do you come up, you don't have to do a weekly column.
I do a
you?
Weekly column
you
for
do.
Computer World, yeah.
So that's hard.
Yes.
But somehow it feels like everything you do is like handmade. Like you really thought a long time and then came up with I'm not blowing smoke, but really a deep insight into that. Yeah. How do you do that?
One of the things that's become rare is thinking in tech journalism.
It's hard to do.
There's a kind of a groupthink echo chamber mentality in tech journalism where it's like people figure out what the consensus is.
Right.
Go with that.
And then they echo it. Yeah.
And I'm kind of old school in that sense.
By the way, Dvorak did the same thing, but he would do it the opposite direction. Yeah. Figure out what the consensus is and then just
the
simply
opposite.
Pick the opposite.
Yeah.
And that works very well. It generated a lot of traffic and heat.
He has his own style.
That's a style.
How he does that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of his columns are like, you know, here's a crazy idea. Like, that's how they strike me. What I like to do is I like to look. So any sort of editorialist opinion column has to be a rectification of something that's wrong in the world.
Uh-huh.
Right? There's something, I think it was William Safire that somebody asked William Safire, how do you come up with a column every week? He's like, well, once a week, the world pisses me off, basically. that's essentially it.
It's easy if you're a political writer.
Right. So either
but that's a little harder if you're a tech writer.
Well, so either people are believing something that isn't quite right, or they're not thinking about something in just the right way. An opinion column can have multiple purposes. Sometimes it's a straightforward opinion. Here's the opinion that is different than you had before, and I'm hopefully by the end of the column you will share this.
Are
opinion.
You always trying to do that?
Yes.
Be didactic to be or persuasive?
Yes, always.
Yeah. Okay.
But sometimes it's kind of like a delivery vehicle for a set of facts in the same way that cigarettes are a delivery vehicle for nicotine.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, you know, and it's a colorful way to do it. So it can be either of those things.
But in both cases, you're trying to
persuade. I'm trying to persuade. Yes. And so there's lots of fodder, but the hardest thing is to be completely original.
Very hard.
On schedule, basically.
Yes.
Every week I have to do an idea that nobody has had.
I always
had
admire
exactly.
that.
And it's really time consuming. And this may surprise people who may have a passing familiarity with like regular journalism, you know, reporting, for example, which is that I spend about 85% of my time, maybe 90%, just coming up with the idea.
Yeah. Thinking.
Just what am I going to say in general?
Yeah.
And then once I have that, the writing column, it's all craft. It's all craft. But it's like
you assemble.
I spend
that then.
Days and days and days thinking. How do I?
Do you think of things and then reject them? Think of more, or how
constantly?
Does that? Okay.
So sometimes I actually come to the conclusion that I have a specific opinion, and then by the time I'm finished with the column, I have the opposite opinion, and I love that.
Well, I've always thought that the best way to know what you think is to write it down.
Yes.
And force yourself to be somewhat rigorous in the writing of it.
That's right. And really, I think it was Mark Twain who basically said who basically said the quality of your writing is very closely related to how much you throw away.
Yeah, well, that must be Hemingway.
And,
although I could see Twain saying it too, yeah.
But you really have to be ready to reject ideas because they
I actually like that. That's valuable for you, right?
Absolutely,
It clarifies your thinking and helps you understand stuff better. And
that's right.
I feel like I should do more writing because it's very easy in speech to pontificate, to inveigh, but not to really be rigorous in your thought.
Yeah, yeah. And you really understand something when you've written it, rewritten it,
yeah.
You know, and
reread
it.
It's much more
it.
Rigorous.
Yeah. Yeah. And so
I can't bring myself to do it. It's too rigorous.
Well, you know, it's
exhausting.
Well, podcasting is exhausting.
It's exhausting in a different way.
Yeah, but doing both is super exhausting.
Yeah, I bet it is. You worked, I feel bad because for the 2 years you did Detectives Today, you worked, I don't think anybody knew how
it was hard a lot of work.
You were up very early in the morning.
Yeah.
And working very hard.
Yeah, I was getting up at 4 every day.
Yeah, wow.
That was fun.
Well, I'm very grateful. It was quality program.
Experience of a lifetime.
It's quality stuff. Yeah. So, but you had a hankering to get back on the road. Now, I'm wondering, because I feel like your wife was very happy to have one kitchen, one house for a couple of years.
Yes. Well, this has been a long evolution, Liam.
Now, she was born in?
She was born in El Salvador.
El Salvador.
Yeah.
And came to the United States as a child? Or?
Yeah, she was like 11, something like that, and went to...
So she certainly had experience of the world.
Yeah.
But did she want to stay home? Or
initially, she did. So when I first came up with this cockamamie idea in 2006, like I said...
Yeah, because I'm trying to persuade Lisa.
All
go ahead.
All you have to do is get rid of your nest. I mean, this is essentially...
Yes, that's hard.
And she was like, no way. That's not happening. Because she loves her kitchen stuff. And
yeah.
She loves her, you know, she's spent a whole lifetime acquiring all this amazing kitchen stuff. Yeah. But over time, the rat race wore her down. Because, you know, we were nomadic for 2 or 3 years. And then she got this job working for AT&T. And it was like an amazing job. And then after a year or two of that, she just couldn't take it anymore. And she's like, let's go. So we've been going back and forth. And now she's just like, let's go. Let's just.
But now you have a granddaughter in the South Bay.
That's right.
In the Bay Area.
Right.
And so you come back, spend time there,
that's
but you
right.
still don't have a house.
I have two sons. One is in the South Bay. One is north of Sacramento. And we store our stuff with the one kid.
Oh, okay.
And sort of like, you know, go in havies on an apartment. That's our home base approach. I talk about it in the book. Until before, we didn't even have a home base. It's easier with a home base when you're
just
gonna be coming
back. Because when you come back, then you have your stuff.
Yeah, we didn't used to come back. I mean, that was the thing.
Right.
But now we come back frequently.
Well, I want to talk about the mechanics of this. We're talking with Mike Elgin. And so in a way, this is a blueprint, right? For if somebody, and I think this is a lot of people's dream.
Yeah.
But a lot of people like me say, but I could never do it.
Yes.
So this would help us, right?
This will help anyone who wants to travel more, even if you want to travel a little bit more. Because this isn't just a sort of manifesto for how to become nomadic full or most of the time. It's a complete alternative to tourism. It's to me, it's the opposite of tourism. Okay, and what I mean by that is, what is a tourist? A tourist is a category of consumer. If you're a tourist, you're a consumer of travel services and products.
I'm a tourist.
Yeah, everybody's a tourist.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. And as you've noticed when you've gone abroad, there are lots of tourists out there.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of fundamentally dissatisfying, too.
Yeah, you're trying to get at the place, but it's just all these other people who are visitors sort of get in the way. So
it becomes Disneyland instead of another country.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the perfect examples, I mean, I know you were in France recently. I think I saw you driving by
on the highway.
And, you know, you go to France and there's this charming old school looking sort of bar, and it's like, oh, Hemingway used to come here.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why do people care about Hemingway? Well, they read A Movable Feast, which is a great book. And what was that about? It wasn't, Hemingway wasn't being a tourist.
He was living in Paris.
He lived in Paris. Yeah. It was about his, he knew people. His friends were there. He shopped there. He bought firewood in the street. He would go to these bars and just hang out for hours.
That's what we want. Yeah.
That's what we want.
It's the year in Provence. There are a million books like this, and we want that.
We want that. And so, we can have that. And the way we can have that is, it's all in the book, but one of the greatest things that ever happened for people who want to actually live in a place rather than be a tourist is sites like Airbnb. We can actually just roll right into somebody's apartment.
It's easier than it used to be.
Well, the thing is that when when Airbnb first opened up in Cuba, for example, within the first few months of it being open, we went to Cuba. And, you know, you go and the person next to you on this side and the person next to you on that side and the person across the hall and the people in your building, nobody is a tourist. Nobody's a visitor. They're all Cubans. And then you go shopping at the store where they shop. And then you, every day you go by and you see the same dog and you like get to know people and you meet friends and you become Cuban. You become French. You become a temporary local in these various places. And food, Leo, is the key. It opens all the doors.
Because we all have to eat.
Well, not only do we all have to eat, food is kind of an expression of culture.
Yes.
So you go and find foodies in any place, and they will suddenly light up, and they want to share it with you.
I remember we had you on Twitter. You were calling from a roof, and I think it was in Fez.
Yeah.
And it was during Ramadan.
Yeah.
And we talked about how everybody had fasted throughout the day, and then when the sun went down, it was a massive party, and we could hear it from the roof.
Yes.
And as a tourist, you'd be in a hotel somewhere, or you'd be back on the boat, and you'd be gone.
That's right.
You had the experience of what it's like to break fast in Ramadan.
Right. And we were living in this 400-year-old Riyadh, just absolute beautiful place. Before we got there, there was some overlap in the schedule, so we were like 3 or 4 days living. We didn't have the whole place to ourselves. We were living with a family. And the man who was the person we interacted with mainly, he said, when you're in my house, you are my family.
Yeah.
We're going to have Ramadan. We're going to break. It's called iftar when they break the fast.
Iftar, right.
And we crowded around this tiny table with, he must have had like 6 or 7 kids of every size and shape. And incredible Ramadan food, and we, you know, would sit there for a couple of hours.
And that breaks the ice. That's totally not like you going to a mosque and walking around. You're there at their table sharing that meal. That is a
in people's
intimate
homes
experience.
At their dining room table, that's where it is. That's where the stories are. That's where the reality is. That's the culture. That's the place.
Yeah.
It's not the services that people are selling you. It's that's the place.
We know that in our own lives, though. Yes. That's in our own lives. Those are the times that we most remember that we, even with just family and friends, that we, those are the times that you remember. Those are the intimate experiences. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
We're talking about with Mike Elgin, old friend, good friend, dear friend, and his wife Amira, who traveled the world, and he still no one knows.
No one knows.
He still writes his column for Computer World and Fast Company, and he's written a new book. This is it. It's called Gastronomad: The Art of Living Everywhere and Eating Everything. And he's got the world on the cover in an ice cream cone, which really does look delicious. By the way, so I have the print edition, which is handy for putting in your backpack as you go around the world and has great pictures. But if you go to, if you buy that for $10, the Amazon Kindle version, you get all of these great pictures in color as well. That is a stunning picture. I'm going to ask you about that in a second. Don't tell me. I'm going to ask you about that in a second. But we'll have more with Mike and learn more about the book. And then let me recommend you go to Amazon, you pick up a copy. Is that the best place? Should they go to your gastronomad.net? Or?
Amazon, search for gastronomad, or you can go to gastronomad.net, either one.
$15 for the paperback, $10 for the Kindle edition. And now I have both. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you are settling down, if you do want a home or you have a home and you want to take advantage of what will be, I can guarantee you, the lowest interest rates for some time because they're going back up, you're going to want to go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation right now. Rocket Mortgage was created by Quicken Loans, the number one lender in terms of customer satisfaction, easily number one lender in the country. That's according to J.D. Power. And it's not just for this year or the last year or the year after that, but the year before that. It's for 8 consecutive years, number one in mortgage origination since 2010, number one in mortgage servicing since 2014. And there's a good reason for that. Quicken Loans, well, it's an interesting story, which I recently, because somebody asked me, well, is that Quicken? And I said, no, I don't think it is. But why is the name the same? Dan Gilbert, that's the name to remember. He's an amazing character, a real entrepreneur, real genius. He had created something called, I think it was Rock Capital. Now you know where the word Rocket Mortgage comes from. I didn't even know that. I hadn't put this two and two together. And sold in 1999, sold Rock Capital to Quicken, and they created Quicken Loans as a loan product. But he wasn't happy. And within 3 years, he bought it back. By the way, he's not a dumb fellow. He sold it for a couple hundred million, bought it back for 50. So worked out for Dan. Took that money. You know what he's, by the way, what he's been doing. He's revitalizing downtown Detroit. He's creating a tech sector there that's amazing. You know the name Quicken Loans because of Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland and so forth. But he's also really built this company up. They still have the name, but it's a separate company, and they have created Rocket Mortgage, I think kind of as a, I don't know, I think a little bit of a insider tribute to their old Rock Capital. Rocket Mortgage is a technological revolution for home lending. First of all, it's entirely online. But even better than that, because it's entirely online, you can do it so simply, you don't have to get paperwork together. You don't have to get bank statements or pay stubs or anything. You share your financial information. They have trusted partnerships with all the financial institutions. I would almost guarantee when you're doing the process, the initial process, which is just a few questions, there won't be anything you just don't know off the top of your head. You don't have to know anything. They get all the information for you. So you go there right now, rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. You can actually start the process. And then when you find a house you want or decide to pull the trigger on a refi, you'll know. We had some people in here the other day who said, yeah, it was the best. We shopped around and we got the best refi rate from Rocket Mortgage and absolutely the easiest way to do this. rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Answer a couple of questions. They crunch the numbers, and within a minute or two, they come back and say, okay, these are the loans you qualify for. You pick the term. You pick the rate. You pick the down payment. You pick the loan. So it's completely transparent. You know every step of the way what you're getting. And then, boom, you're approved. You could literally do that. You could go to an open house, decide to buy it then, and then a minute or two later show the realtor, yeah, we're approved for the loan. Let's buy it. We're going to make an offer. That's how fast it is, how easy it is. No faxing documents, no going into the basement for all those boxes, none of that. Rocketmortgage.com/triangulation, equal housing lender license in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently with Rocket Mortgage. Rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. It's funny. I've known Mike for so long, and I've never sat down and learned about you. So it's good to have a meal, but it's also good to do a triangulation with people.
That's right.
Like.
I recommend it to everyone.
It's a wonderful thing. Mike's new book, The Art of Living. Is this your first book you've written?
Yes, it is.
Really?
No, it's first
no
book.
Computer books, huh?
No.
Smart man.
I really enjoyed writing it. I tell you that. I'm going to write a lot more books.
Don't write any computer books.
Because they become obsolete before you publish.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. I wrote a lot of them, and it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
But this was not so much work.
It was a labor of love.
Yeah, I
truly.
Think so. And you can tell when you look at the pictures. This one is great. This I remember when you were in. Where was this? Morocco, also?
In Morocco. Southern Morocco, where the Sahara meets Morocco. This was actually last year. And this is actually one of the great entrepreneurial stories that I've ever encountered. We wanted to sleep in the desert under the stars. That was our dream. And so we did a lot of searching. We found this
There's
guy.
There's no Muhammad. Airbnb tents.
There, no. And so we found this small company run by a guy named Muhammad, who ran the whole company with two phones. And this is a guy with no shoes, who's a Berber. And he started out, he bought a couple camels and gave people rides. And then he eventually saved his money and he bought some camel hair tents. And then he put them in the middle, you know, not in the middle, but in, like in the Sahara. And so you ride camels for a long time.
You're on a camel when you take this picture.
That picture was taken from a camel.
That's the other camel, his camel.
And that's our guide there scampering up a pretty high dune. But you take this camel, and this poor guy, just we were talking about Ramadan, no water, no food all day.
Wow.
He's in direct sun for hours. Quite a bit of endurance there. So they take you out to this Berber camp in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they're just nowhere. There's sand dunes as far as the eye can see. And I'm thinking, okay, the food is going to be sandy, and it's going to be worth it. It was the best food.
Leo. No.
They did tagines.
Oh, I love tagines.
Best
those
tagines.
Are those clay pots that are, and then I guess the shape, the moisture kind of, I don't know, magic happens inside them.
So we sat there under the light of basically a smartphone was the only light. Eating these tagines.
Wow.
And, you know, a couple of guys that were with us, and that was it. It was just us and the guides.
And tents, and you're going to spend the night?
As soon as we got there and the sun went down, they vanished to go break.
They wanted to eat. They wanted their iftar.
I don't know where they went.
It's iftar time, baby.
Exactly. And then eventually they came back, cooked us this dinner. It was fantastic. And then we slept out in the open under the stars, like you're in the Milky Way, just part of it.
Oh.
And it was really astonishing. The sounds, everything about it was great. We got up, watched the sun come up.
That's the kind of experience. You probably do have to be living there to find those people and set it up and have it make it work.
Timing is everything. And the reason this was such great timing is that we found exactly the moment when the moon was at its lowest. So there was no moon.
So it's pitch black.
And all that stuff. But this is one of the great things about if you travel a lot more and you do it nomadically, you have all kinds of flexibility about when you travel, where you go.
So you're not talking about a house trade or getting a house for a year in Provence. You're talking about just Airbnb. What typically, how long do you stay?
About 3 months, but I'm not, I mean, those are great options as well.
You can do that too.
There's a million options. There's a service even, Leo, where you sign up and you live in the house of another person who's part of that service and you all just swap.
Yeah.
You just keep going every month.
But you never stop.
You never stop. Well, when you want to stop, you stop and you
say, okay, I'm going home.
You move in. Yeah. But
that's interesting. I could do that.
Yes. Yes, you could.
That sounds like fun.
It does, isn't it? And so you could, you know, there's a million options. The sharing economy is fantastic. But typically what we do is 3 months is good. 3 months is a good amount of time to live in a place. You can stock up full of groceries and olive oil and everything. And you get situated and as fast as you can, and then you get to busy living there.
What do you bring with you? How much do you bring with you?
Two bags. So I have a carry-on and a check luggage.
That's it?
That's it. And that's what we live out of.
Wow.
Each. To each.
And that's mostly clothing or?
It's not a lot of clothing, just the minimum amount of clothing. It's, of course, depends on the seasons. I have all my tech stuff on my laptop.
Tell us about the tech stuff you bring.
Yeah, so it's the same stuff that anybody else would have. So I have a MacBook Pro, I have a iPad Pro, iPhone. You have to have the converters for the power. You need pocket chargers because sometimes you can't always get reliable electricity. A few options for connecting with Ethernet if you can, or you know. But
my
it's pretty strange.
Part of this book and of your Instagram feed is your pictures of your office.
Yes,
my office for today. This was I think in Morocco still, right?
That's right.
This is your office for the day, and so is internet access pretty ubiquitous, pretty widely available?
It's widely available. It's not always super fast. So, for example, in that particular location, that's right across from, I think it's Ben Hout, it was called. That's where they filmed both Gladiator and also Game of Thrones. They did a Game of Thrones there. They CGI'd the top of it.
By the way, my experience has been anywhere you go, they've done Game of Thrones there.
That's right.
I saw the staircase into the pit where the I told you this the other day, where they put the mother of dragons, right. put her dragons.
That's right.
That's and they said, don't look at that. You can't look at that. Yeah. That's the Game of Thrones area. You can't look at that. No pictures, please. And it wasn't like Emilia Clarke was there. It was just, you know, no pictures.
Well, how do you know?
They had a guard. They had a guard.
Totally weird.
Anyway, okay.
Anyway, but that's a perfect example Beautiful. Of where there is Wi-Fi there, but really slow Wi-Fi. I mean, that
so
was,
you can't Skype, but you could upload your stories. You could do research.
Yeah, and it all depends. I mean, you can go to there are other countries. You can go to South Korea, and the internet's way faster.
Yeah, I need to find places I could podcast from.
Yeah.
You could do that, though.
You've
joined us many times from many locations.
One of the things that we look for, when we were recently in Barcelona, for example, we had fiber. You know, super fast.
Nice.
You can find those things in most European countries. It's harder to find super fast internet connectivity, but you can do it. And it's super important. I mean, it's like the faster, the better.
Yeah. So ubiquitous internet has made a difference in this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I mean, in the early days, it was harder to find, but easier to connect.
Right.
Nowadays, it's easier to find and harder to connect because they want a password.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Wi-Fi options in Europe where you essentially reconnect every hour.
Do you think you'll be able to do it on LTE on a cell service pretty soon? Like, that's all you'd really need?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're almost there.
Yep.
I can tell this is Ia. This is. Santorini in Greece. Oh.
That was a sweet, sweet apartment, I tell you.
That pool was part of the apartment?
Yes.
And by the way, that's your beautiful wife, Amira.
Yep.
And there's your office in the lower left-hand corner.
There's my office. You can tell this is from 2007. You can tell by the laptop.
Yep. that's the only... By the way, everything else is ageless, including Amira. But you can always tell by the technology ages faster than anything. When you first started doing this, was it... wrenching at all? I mean, did you have to you had to get rid of stuff, right?
Yeah, several times we've gotten rid of almost all our stuff, and
that's got to be wrenching.
It's really hard. You have far more stuff than you think you do. Yeah. It's a general rule.
Yeah,
and putting stuff in storage is pretty difficult, but it's a great discipline. You really sort of confront the idea of what's important and what isn't important, and this is really part of the economy of the future. In the future, I think people will rent a lot more and own a lot less. I think people will be already are more happy to spend on experiences rather than stuff.
Yeah,
and those are both fantastic trends that are radically accelerated when you want to travel a lot more.
I think one thing that has happened in the modern world is we have too much crap. We have more. I was just reading the other day. In every era, up until the very most recent era, people would have a handful of artifacts, maybe a book, maybe a rag doll. But now we are surrounded by human-made artifacts our whole life.
Yeah.
And there must be, even as hard as it is, when it's all said and done, kind of a relief to let it all go.
Absolutely is. And the truth is that when you live nomadically and travel constantly, you actually have access to even more stuff than you do back home.
You just don't take it with you.
You just don't take it with you. It's other people's stuff, which is the best kind.
It's other people's stuff.
You know?
All right. Tell us the negatives, though. There's got to be some negatives.
Yeah, there are lots.
You address loneliness, for instance.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I did that whole chapter on the negatives is that so much of the nomad literature is rosy and sunny.
Yeah.
And looks easy and all this stuff. It's not easy. There are lots of things, everything, and I've got a lot of stories in there about, you know, crime, terrorism, the air quality that you sometimes contend with.
I remember in Cuba, you had some really, they were spraying pesticides.
They were.
In the apartment.
Zika virus was something they were eradicating by going house to house every week, every single week. Oof. They would fumigate every house in the country and then every town. So they would fumigate actually the streets. And you'd ask Cubans, what are they spraying? Oh, don't worry about it. This government says it's safe.
It's surely okay.
Yeah. But it was, we were gasping for air this most recent time, pretty much the whole time we were in Cuba.
Yeah.
So that's an example.
But you have to be, you have to have a mindset that you don't say, this is horrible. I wish we were home.
Yeah, no.
So how do you approach it?
The way I look at it is that there are trade-offs between nomadic living and what I call residential living. So there are comforts and conveniences to just having a house and living in a place and doing all that stuff. And at the same token, depending on where you go, there are inconveniences and discomforts that occur all the time. I mean, one of the examples that I like to give is just the sheer. I mean, there's really nothing. You know, the United States is an easy place to live. It's a bubble of comfort and security. When we lived, for example, even in Florence, which is obviously a really beautiful
urban modern city,
exactly. But we lived in this like little closet because we booked at the last minute. We wanted to be near the Arno River, so we're in a drafty, humid closet with no windows and all that kind of stuff. And it was fantastic, Leo. It wasn't because it was comfortable. It was fantastic because it was so new to us to live in the medieval part of a city.
Oh wow!
And so. It was is really fantastic in that regard. I talk about getting ripped off twice in Spain. The pickpockets are the world's best.
Yes.
They are just so good at what they do.
Everybody I know has been robbed in Spain.
Yeah.
Except me. But we're going. We're going this fall, so I plan to get robbed in Barcelona.
You will. I assure you. there are all kinds of subtle weird things that I talk about. The idea of professional marginalizations. People sometimes treat you like you're on vacation. And so you're like, oh, you're off somewhere. I don't know where you are. Whereas if you are like in an industry town, like we're near Silicon Valley.
Then they know you're working. Right?
They want to see you like with all the other Silicon Valley
worse.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a whole, I've got a whole chapter on that kind of stuff. But the thing that balances it on the whole, and I think this is something that we need. So what's wrong with the world today? I mean, let's look at it the biggest possible picture. What's wrong is that we've all separated into
these
tribes.
We're all in silos.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, and tourism doesn't quite get you all the way there. And
no.
So I think
it's almost like you're looking through a window at the other place.
And so the gastronomad idea is actually the ultimate goal of it is that it's a mindset. It changes who you are and how you look at your fellow humanity. Because when you actually go and live in the same place that people live in all these different countries, and you shop in the same stores, and you make friends with everybody, and you do this repeatedly, it completely transforms how you look at the concept of other, because it ceases to exist. And the entire planet becomes like your hometown. The ability
to go. We kind
of
need that now.
Yes, we do. And if I could, I would send every single American to go live abroad in some random corner of the world for as long as they could, so that you can experience how fantastic it is to really get to know people in a totally different culture.
So that makes up for the negatives, for the occasional blips.
It absolutely does. Because again,
that's part of the process.
It's not just about experiencing things. It's about transforming yourself.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, that's been by far the most rewarding thing about this lifestyle, is that you become a different kind of person. You look at the world differently. You look at humanity differently. And everything is colored by that perspective of, you know, the sense that we are all the same and that we are all excited about our cultures and about, you know, the food we eat and our histories and all of the rest. Every place I've been, I've met people who are filled with generosity and love, and it's been incredibly rewarding.
And if you're, as I am, a little reluctant to sell everything and run out the door, Mike and Amira do something that might be a great start.
Yeah.
Your gastronomad.
Our gastronomad experiences. This actually emerged organically. Out of our conversations online, because people are like, wow, I wish I could join you.
I want to do that.
Doing all this stuff. Because everywhere we go, so what we do is we unravel the thread of foodies. So we'll go to a place and we just gravitate toward like this amazing food places of different type. There might be bakeries or restaurants or whatever. And then we just so excited about what they're doing. We introduce ourselves. We make friends with somebody. All the foodies always know each other. So one foodie will introduce us to another foodie. A cheesemaker will introduce us to a winemaker, who will introduce us to a farmer, who will introduce us to a restaurateur. And next thing you know, it takes 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks sometimes, we've got this network of
your local
super
expert.
Foodies. Right. And so what we realize is that we can spend the months that it takes to really sort of gather all the knowledge about the local food scene. And then we can drop people in for like a week And we can introduce us to introduce them to all of our friends to experience all
neat.
The things in a condensed.
You become a local
week.
Guide,
right? So the picture you have on screen there that is from the Barcelona experience. We're in the Cava country at one of our friend's house, having an amazing meal after an incredible day of just exploring the cheese scene, the Cava making scene, and this is what it's all about: at the table with great friends, excited about food culture. And so, yeah, so we're doing one in Provence, and then
Prosecco, right?
Prosecco, the Prosecco Hills area of Italy,
that's Italy.
North of Venice. Like, think about Venice, like an hour straight up, right, north. And then we're doing Mexico City at the end of the year, and then we're going to keep doing a bunch of these. They're just
so fantastic. It's going well.
It's going really
well,
because I
remember when you said, let's do this. And you've done two now?
We've done one, just Barcelona. It was a raging success. And
thing
that I did not expect was that the people who came on this, our gastronomads, they became our very dear friends.
Oh, isn't
and because
that neat?
You're experiencing this stuff together.
Yeah.
And you can click through. This is all the Barcelona experience. And, you know, you've been to Barcelona. You know what it's
wonderful.
The food scene is
some
like that.
Paella.
And, you know, there's a paella class on us. But we, you know, this is an all-star team of people that we assembled for this to teach us how to make paella, teach us how to do cheese the Spanish way, teach us how to make cava, teach us all the stuff.
Fun.
And so it was an amazing experience.
So your next one you said is where?
Is Prosecco Hills.
Prosecco. And that's going to be the spring?
It's going to be in spring and then Provence in the summer.
Gastronomad.net if people want to know more.
That's right.
And sign up and find out about it. That might be a kind of a first step.
It's a perfect first step because, you know, you buy your own airfare and then you don't spend a penny after that. We handle all the everything.
Nice. Okay.
And you're just with a group of people, group of friends.
But it's not a tour.
Not a tour at all. No.
It's a real experience.
We're a group of friends just there to, like, just deeply experience the food culture of the place. And it was one of the greatest things I've personally been.
And I can vouch personally for Mike and Amira's hospitality and Amira's cooking. And if you want to know more, you can read the book, too, which is available, as I said, on Amazon and at gastronomad.net. Gastronomad, the art of living everywhere and eating everything. And maybe an antidote for our modern materialistic times. Break out of our silo and see the world.
I think so.
Yeah. Too bad I have a 10-year lease here. So, but maybe there's some podcasters around the world who'd want to trade studios. We could do the same thing you do with the houses, but we'll do it with studios.
It's brilliant.
We'll just move around different studios. It's all right. You can come too. Yeah. Mike, it's always a pleasure when you do come back to the States. And then it's just as much of a pleasure when I follow you on Instagram or on Twitter or on your website and, of course, on gastronomad.net to see what you're up to. Because as close as I get anyway to kind of vicariously enjoying the gastronomad life.
Well,
I'm so glad that you continue to do this.
Thank you for having me on, and it's been a pleasure. And, you know, I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Always
I love
a
this
pleasure.
Show.
Yeah.
This is like one of my favorite shows ever.
Thank you.
And it's just great to be here.
Maybe I should just start doing it in places all around the world. We do triangulation still from our Northern California studios. It's not bad being in Northern California.
It's
not the worst
here.
Place to be. You lived here for a couple of years.
So it was beautiful so driving bad. In today. The weather was amazing.
I know. You can watch the show. We do it now. As I said, it's not just me now. It's Mike Elgin. I wish. No, it's Megan Maroney and Jason Howell and Father Robert Ballester. We rotate. So each of us gets an interview once a month. And it's usually Fridays, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2300 UTC. But you can also check the calendar at twit.tv/cal. To see when the next episode, because sometimes they move around a little bit. But one thing you can be sure of, if you can't watch live, which you can do at twit.tv/live, is that you'll be able to get it as soon as it's ready if you subscribe. So go to your favorite podcast application and subscribe, or go to twit.tv/TRI. You can see all the back episodes there, the many we've done over the years, with many more to come. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. On triangulation. Bye-bye. Oh, I'm so jealous. I don't know if I could ever do this. I just don't.
You know, the thing is, and I think we've actually talked about this before, but it's the video and the live. That's where You know what I mean?
Yeah, my mistake. But I've made my bed, and I have to sleep in it. But
I've always thought that, you know, it's like...
I'm going to be a tourist for a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's...
My fear is I'll be too old by the time I retire, because then that I could totally do it. I guess you could be kidding. I mean, as long as I can get around.
You'll have one of those floating chairs like in WALL-E, you know, with the beverage and the screen.
I might need one. I realize since I don't have stairs anymore anywhere, at home or here, that it's hard work getting upstairs all of a sudden. So I'm going to have to go to the... Now, from now on, when I do the gym, I'm going to have to do a stair climber. Like, they actually have a moving staircase. Or just step up and down there. Yeah. One step.
So my recommendation, though, is that even if you're going for... You know, you're always... You travel frequently.
Yeah,
you
because I would be doing what you are doing if right. I could. We travel as much as we can.
But the one thing that I would...
Maybe we shouldn't be doing it the way we do it, which is, but instead get an Airbnb for those 2 weeks.
So what you do is, so Airbnb is a very complicated and kind of manipulative service, and the way to get around it is Google Images. So you start with you start with treehouse with an ocean view, and then
those people's website,
and then you look at the photos. No, you look at the photos.
Right.
You go,
once you find a photo, then you click on that and go to that website.
That'll click you into Airbnb, and then you can find it that way. So all the photos on Airbnb
are on Google.
On Google image search, and to me that is, you can spend the rest of your life looking at these amazing properties, because really it's the photos you want to you know when you see it, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, and you're absolutely right.
You can stay in castles, Leo. You can stay in boats. You can, you know, there's so many options.
It's fear that holds us back.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you buy a package tour, you don't have to think about it.
Right.
You know, depending on who you get it from, you know what it's going to be like. You have a pretty good idea what you're going to get. Right. But it's always, I'm always nervous that, I might get there. Once Jennifer and I, some time ago, rented, it was actually in the back of the KQED magazine in, Zihuatanejo.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful picture of a palapa up in the trees. And we thought, Abby was a little baby at the time. We thought, oh, this will be perfect. And we went, and Jennifer was pregnant, and it involved climbing up into this thing, and then there were monkeys coming in and animals coming in, and the soap was gnawed and stuff because it was just open treehouse.
The monkeys were chewing on the soap?
Yeah. Well, some monkeys or something.
Huh.
But monkeys would come in, and you couldn't... We had Abby in a playpen, kind of, you know, sleeping playpen, and I thought, they're going to carry her away.
Friend who they have a little dog, and they were living in Kenya, and the dog almost bird carried
picked it up.
Yeah, and so they shipped the dog back to the U.S. because it was so traumatized. It was the dog's Vietnam. It was like horrifying.
So we just went. We said, you know, this is great, and we went down and walked down the beach. So we found a hotel, and we ate the, you know, weeks.
The beauty is that Airbnb is a reputation based, so you get the perfect rating.
That Airbnb is a much better system, I think.
And you really have to grill them. Like we discovered a million little gotchas.
Tell me some of these tips.
Well, one of the things is that sometimes some Airbnbs won't. If you want to use sheets, that's like $20 extra, and if you want a towel, it's another $20.
Oh, wow.
And so, there are a lot of gotchas like that. The biggest gotcha, though, is when the place, like, you look at the pictures, you're like, oh my God, this is heaven on earth. Look at this. This is amazing. You get there and you're like,
this is not the
picture. You're in the middle of nowhere in a bad way.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You go to France because you want to be near a village.
Right.
But if it's like 6 hours of hitchhiking to get to
right.
the So those are the kinds of things.
But
so we
you
have
figure
whole,
that out. You look on the map.
You grill the host.
Oh, right? Okay.
We have a whole quest, you know, a way to
is
grill the host.
Is that in the book?
Yes.
How to grill the host?
How to grill the host.
Not just grill the fish, but how to grill the host.
Yeah. And the other biggest problem is people don't really think through how they're going to get to the place. So you think, oh, we're just going to roll in there and we're going to be. No, you're going to show up at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
You're going to have no cell reception.
Right.
It's going to be dark.
How do you figure out? Yeah.
And it's like there are no addresses posted, and there you are with your luggage after traveling for 18 hours. And so that's key. Always make sure that
know
you
where the
have
key is.
Entrance strategy.
Yeah, that's always the few times we've done Airbnb. That's always been the interesting thing is when you get there.
And so the first thing we always say is you get a host and say, exactly how are we going to get to your place?
Right.
And if they say, you know what, it might be easier if I just pick you up. You say, yes, that one.
That's
pick
a good
us
one.
Up.
Pick us up, because then they'll walk you right in the door.
Right.
I think that's the next thing for us is instead of booking these tours, taking the chance and just doing Airbnbs at least, right? Then we're in one place for 2 weeks.
Yep.
That's not as good as 3 months, but it's better than nothing.
It's
a start.
A million times better than nothing. I mean, it's great. It's really great. And, you know, there's just something, you know, you have this.
We kind of didn't like our trip in France because it was a talc tour and it was very regimented. And we actually didn't really like it that much. Yeah. It really wasn't as fun as I had hoped it would be because the places we were great.
Right.
Provence is amazing.
Yeah.
And there were some good things. Like they arranged to go to, you know, meet the Duke, who's the 17th generation in that castle. He's been making wine.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool stuff. So there's some advantage to some of that stuff.
Right.
But the regimentation, I don't want to ever get in another bus again.
I mean, we when we were in Provence, it was just like some of the places we stayed were so beautiful, you know, ancient, medieval.
Oh, I want to go back. Apartments. I was making notes.
Yeah, and so you know, we were in this one apartment that's right across the cobblestone lane from the castle.
Oh my
and,
God!
But we had to take care of the cat. Right? There's
so
a cat.
What?
We had to feed the
Lisa
cat. But that was
that.
Fun.
Lisa
anyway,
would love that.
Absolutely.
If you get a cat with every apartment, she'd be thrilled.
Free cat.
Yeah. That's the one thing keeping her from going. We watched last night, there's a great documentary on Netflix about the cats of Istanbul. It was wonderful. Kedi.
Do you ever go see the Hemingway's cats in Key West?
Key West? No, you know, we're trying to, so one of the things we're now freaked out about is what do you do about taxes? You're still a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, I pay taxes. You know,
so you're just like you were making the money
I don't pay
here.
Property taxes, but it's
right.
Like, you know.
So they're going to start. We don't have a deduction for local taxes anymore. So we're thinking we have to move to a low tax or zero, more likely zero tax. So we're actually. I said I would love to live in Key West. There's only one problem: is the hurricanes.
Yeah.
So, but I would love. I love the Florida Keys. Yeah. They're beautiful.
Yeah, me too.
Hemingway's cats.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been to the Hemingway house.
Yeah,
I didn't notice the cats. There's a lot of cats.
There's six-toed cats, and there's like
they're famous.
Dozens of
I remember that. Yeah, I love Key West, but anywhere in the Keys, are beautiful. Yeah. I don't know.
We're always looking.
I feel like I took a wrong turn in my life.
Well, you know, here's something that surprised us because we're always looking because. We love tropical places. We love tropical places. Like, where is a tropical place or a Caribbean-like place?
Yeah.
Where
I know I love
it's
the tropics.
Not too Caribbean. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And for our conclusion was the best place is the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico.
Oh.
There are all kinds of really cool places there.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's like the Caribbean.
Yeah,
but.
It is. It's on the Caribbean.
It's on the Caribbean, but even inland or whatever, all that. So once you go south of Cancun, and all down in that part of the area.
Yeah, it was in Merida last year, I think. Yeah. She really liked it.
It gets really cool. Like, it's really beautiful. And, you know, that part of Mexico is very...
It's different. It's more Caribbean.
It's more Caribbean, but it's not third worldy at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the problems with Cancun, the city, because we live there... Outside, not in the hotel zone, but in the regular city, it's way too American.
Yeah.
There's
I don't
Costco
want that.
And a,
yeah,
and
I don't
Walmart
want that
everywhere
all.
And all that stuff.
Yeah.
But you go down, like for example, not Cozumel. What is the town right on the inland on the mainland part away from Cozumel? Blanking on it, but it's like this town that just has burgeoned recently, and it's a cool little town.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's tourism. There's like a main drag.
Is there so? Do you start meeting the same people over and over again? I mean, is there like a community? Because I know we have Winton Churchill, who's does seminars on how to do this and stuff. And he has like a community of people that he does this.
Not in multiple places. So like when we go to Italy, we have these great friends there.
Yeah.
Actually, that's starting to happen because the gastronomic experiences, we had re-sign-ups. So people in Barcelona are
People had such fun, they're coming back?
Yeah, absolutely. And so...
You know what? This is going to be a good business. This is going to be a good little business. I like it.
It is.
I'm sure Amira's thrilled.
She is.
Yeah.
And she, you know, the funny thing is it doesn't feel like work.
No, to it's us. Fun.
It's so much
it's more,
fun.
It's actually a continuation of what you're already doing,
yeah.
Really.
I mean, and it's a lot of work, especially for Mira, because
sure
she's got
it
to, set everything. But she loves doing
but
that.
But she doesn't
stuff.
Mind doing that, yeah.
Yeah, she really enjoys
she's
it.
She's really good. She's, yeah, this is better than having a restaurant. This is kind of like that.
Yeah.
Satisfies that, but without having the day-to-day.
Right. I think next year
grind.
We're going to do Georgia, Fez, and a couple of other favorite places.
Neat.
Yeah, but Georgia is a mind blower. Of a town.
Yeah, yeah. We still haven't tried that wine.
Yeah.
I have it.
You'll
I
love it.
Try it. Yeah.
You'll love it. So
I don't know if Lisa's here or not, but if she is, say hi. But maybe, yeah, I'm going to have to rethink my travel strategy.
Yeah.
We have two trips already booked, but then...
So Tokyo, Japan?
Japan is in April, and then we're doing a... It's a cruise, though, see? So it's Western Mediterranean, but it starts and ends in Barcelona. Mm. We're going to Tangiers, which will be fun.
Oh, great. Yeah.
But it's a cruise, so it's one day. Like, you get in at 9, and you leave at 5.
Tangiers is, like, the most wonderfully shady town there is.
It's is it?
Just, yeah.
Fez would be better?
Just nothing like Fez.
Nothing like Fez.
So, Tangiers, yeah, they're opposites, I would say. Fez is a real place where, you know, it's just like a very Moroccan, very...
Right.
Of itself, kind of a place. I don't know how else to describe it. Tangier is this freak of a place that's always been on the coast, full of pirates and shady characters
Sounds
from all
great.
Over the place. Yeah, it's...
Tangier is where, like, the Rolling Stones went when they...
Yeah.
I mean, that was, like, where you would go in the 60s.
Yeah.
Because you could get hash.
Yeah. It's
and they would live. They lived there for a long time. I think.
Yeah, it's a pretty insane place. I mean, one of the things that freaked us out immediately when we went there the first time was there's like packs of feral dogs that kind of like follow you around.
That's scary.
Like,
I don't mind feral cats. It's feral dogs I worry about.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it's very kind of Europeanized in a way. Like there's just cafes everywhere. The like European style cafes all over the place.
This is Fez.
No, Tangier.
This is Tangier.
Fez is another world. It's like a holodeck because when you're in the old Medina of Fez, it's like you're in the oldest continuously occupied city in the world.
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. You are back in time. It's covered everywhere. So you're kind of indoors, even when you're outdoors. And it's just the labyrinthine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Habit trails
so interesting.
Everywhere. And you never discover the whole place. And you never not get lost.
You kind of want to do this before everything changes.
Yeah.
Before everything turns into Tangier.
I mean, but Fez,
or
I get the feeling when I'm in Fez, this is a place that is unchangeable.
Like yeah.
And it's what's cool about it is that, yeah, there's some visitors and tourists around, but really the dominant vibe is Fez people living in Fez.
Yeah.
Like they're just living their lives.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I classified all the food stuff in Fez according to the degree to which they cater to tourists. And it's super easy to find the ones that don't cater to tourists at all.
Right.
And the food is fantastic.
Right.
Little tagine places. And there's this one guy we love who just has all manner
When's your
of all
Fez
of
us.
We're almost certainly going to do it next year, 2019.
Good.
Yeah.
So the minute you know a date, because we haven't booked, we have booked up this year, but next year we haven't anything booked.
Yeah, you'd love the one thing
that sounds like a perfect one for us to do.
Yeah, you'd love Fez. The only downside is people don't wear Fezes there. So
I was gonna wear my Fez.
Yeah, you'll be the only one. Everybody wears baseball hats. But other than
that's not why I want to go. No, let us know when you do that
one.
That's the one we'll go to.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll introduce you to my Moroccan barber.
I want to sleep
kid
in the desert.
This little closet one of the alleys.
And I want to sleep outside in the desert.
Yeah.
I want to do all of that stuff.
You would love that. We'll connect you with Muhammad. He's the guy.
The camel guy.
The camel guy.
Camel jockey Muhammad.
Yep.
Oh, so
go on
so
hump
neat.
Day. Something like that.